My Journey to Lhasa. The personal story of the only white woman who succeeded in entering the Forbidden City. By Alexandra David Neal. This made as audiobook for personal use from text found online, and may be scanning mistakes here, which creates a partially incomprehensible translation. PDF can be found online of this book for following the reading here if desired. Introduction. My travels in remote parts of Asia, including my fifth expedition, a journey to Tibet, of which I give a short account in the present book, were undertaken as the result of certain peculiar circumstances, and a brief resume of these may not be uninteresting to the reader. Ever since I was 5 years old, a tiny precocious child of Paris, I wished to move out of the narrow limits in which, like all children of my age, I was then kept. I craved to go beyond the garden gate, to follow the road that passed it by, and to set out for the unknown. But, strangely enough, this unknown fancied by my baby mind always turned out to be a solitary spot where I could sit alone, with no one near, and as the road toward it was closed to me I sought solitude behind any bush, any mound of sand, that I could find in the garden, or wherever else my nurse took me. Later on, I never asked my parents for any gifts except books on travel, maps, and the privilege of being taken abroad during my school holidays. When a girl, I could remain for hours near a railway line, fascinated by the glittering rails and fancying the many lands toward which they fed. But, again, my imagination did not evoke towns, buildings, gay crowds, or stately pageants. I dreamed of wild hills, immense deserted steppes and impassable landscapes of glaciers. When grown up, although I was in no sense a sedentary scholar, my love of Oriental philosophy and of comparative religion won me a position as a writer and a lecturer in a Baekjin university. I had already travelled in the East when, in 1910, I was commissioned by the French Ministry of Education to proceed to India and Burma to make some Oriental researches. At that time the ruler of Tibet, the Dalai Lama, had fled from his capital because of political troubles with China, and had taken refuge in an Himalayan village in British Bhutan, called Klimpong. Tibet was not altogether unfamiliar to me. I had been a pupil of the Sanskrit and Tibetan scholar, Professor Edouard Foucaux, of the College de France, and knew something of Tibetan literature. Naturally, I wanted to see the Tibetan Pope King and his court. I was informed by the British resident that this was not easy. For up to that time this exalted Lama had obstinately refused to receive foreign ladies. But I had managed to secure praying letters of introduction from high Buddhist personages, and the result was that the desire of the Dalai Lama to see me grew even stronger than mine to see him. Around the monk sovereign, I found a strange royal household of clerical personages, clad in shining yellow satin, dark, red cloth, and gold brocade, who related fantastic stories and spoke of a wonderland. Although when listening to them I wisely made a liberal allowance for legend and exaggeration, I instinctively felt that behind those dark wooded hills which I saw before me, and the huge snowy peaks which pointed their lofty heads beyond them, there was, truly, a land different from all others. Needless to say, my heart leapt with the desire to enter it. It was in June of the year 1912 that I had my first glimpse of Tibet. The path which I had preferred to the road most usually taken starts from a low point in Sikkim, amid tropical vegetation, wild orchids, and the living fireworks of fireflies. Gradually, as one climbs, the scenery changes, nature becomes severe, the singing of birds and the noisy buzzing of insects subside. The huge trees, in their turn, are unable to struggle in the rarefied air of the summits. With each mile the forest becomes more stunted, till the shrubs are reduced to the size of dwarfs creeping on the ground, while still higher up they cannot even continue to exist. The traveller is left amidst rocks richly embroidered with brightly coloured lichens, cold waterfalls, half frozen lakes and giant glaciers. Then from the Sipo Pass one suddenly discovers the immensity of the Trans-Himalayan tableland of Tibet, with its distant horizon of peaks bathed in strange mauve and orange hues, and carrying queerly shaped caps of snow upon their mighty heads. What an unforgettable vision! I was at last in the calm solitudes of which I had dreamed since my infancy. I felt as if I had come home after a tiring, cheerless pilgrimage. However, the very peculiar natural aspect of Tibet is not the only reason for the attraction which that country has exercised over me. Like many Oriental scholars, of whom Lambert an humble colleague, I deeply regret the loss, in their Sanskrit original, of a number of Mahayanist Buddhist scriptures. These are more or less available in Chinese translations, but what is the extent of the Tibetan translation and what original philosophic and mystic works have been written by Tibetan authors, either in accordance with Mahayanist doctrines or contrary to them, is as much terra incognita as the land of Tibet itself. Thus, hunting after books and old manuscripts and seeking meetings with the literati of the country became my self-assigned task. Anyhow, things could not end there. The unsuspected is the daily fare of the traveler in Tibet, and my researches led me face to face with a world still more amazing than the landscapes I had beheld from the high passes through which one enters Tibet. I refer to the mystic anchorites, the dwellers on the frozen summits. But this is a subject to be treated elsewhere. Strange as the fact may appear, I must confess that, unlike most travelers who have attempted to reach Lhasa, and have failed to reach their goal, I never entertained a strong desire to visit the sacred Lamaist city. I had, as I have said, met the Dalai Lama, and as for researches regarding the literature, philosophy, and secret lore of Tibet, these things could be pursued more profitably amongst the literal and mystics. In the freely accessible and more intellectual parts of northeastern Tibet, than in the capital, so what decided me to go to Lhasa was, above all, the absurd prohibition which closes Tibet. A prohibition? One could hardly think it possible that extends over a gradually increasing area, is now placed on foreigners who wish to cross territories over which they could travel at will a few years ago, and where, in a still more ancient period, missionaries have even owned properties. As an instance, the French traveler, M. Bacot, crossed the Zarong province and visited Mekong in 1909. Captain F. Kingdom Ward visited the same region in 1911 and again in 1914. In 1924 he went to Pima Kojan, being at the time commissioned by the British government or, at least, allowed by it to travel in Tibet. In 1860 the French Roman Catholic missionaries had established several quarters in the Zarong province. M. Fernand Grenard, Sven Hedin and others, who failed in their attempts to reach Lhasa, had nevertheless crossed part of the northern Tibetan solitudes before being stopped. No one, nowadays, could openly proceed so far in the country. But, in more remote periods, Lhasa itself has been open to those who did not shrink from the hardships of such a journey. Several missionaries and lay travelers not only entered the sacred Lamaist city but made prolonged stays there. To support my statement, I quote here what has been written on the subject by Edmund Candler, who accompanied the British military expedition to Lhasa in 1904. It must be remembered that Tibet has not always been closed to strangers. Until the end of the 18th century, only physical obstacles stood in the way of an entry to the capital. Jesuits and Capuchins reached Lhasa, made long stays there and were even encouraged by the Tibetan government. The first Europeans to visit the city and leave an authentic record of their journey were the Fathers Gruber and D'Orville, who penetrated Tibet from China in 1661 by the Sining Road and stayed in Lhasa 2 months. Friar Roderick of Portone is supposed to have visited Lhasa in 1325, but the authenticity of this record is open to doubt. In 1715 the Jesuits Desiderian Freire reached Lhasa and stayed the 13 years. In 1719, arrived Horace de la Panacea and the Capuchin Mission, who built a chapel and a hospice, made several converts and were not finally expelled till 1740. The Dutchman Van der Put, first Lathan to penetrate to the capital, arrived in 1720, and stayed there some years. After this, we have no record of a European reaching Lhasa until the journey of Thomas Manning, the first and only Englishman to reach the city before this year. Manning arrived in the retinue of a Chinese general whom he had met at Farijong and whose gratitude he had won for medical services. My wanderings in Tibet began with a few excursions across the tableland which extends immediately to the north of the Himalayas. A few years later I paid a visit to the Panchen Lama, better known to foreigners under the name of Tashi Lama. I was most cordially welcomed. The High Lama wished me to stay with him for a long time, if not forever. He offered me free access to all libraries, and a lodging either in a nunnery or in a hermitage or in a house in the town of Shigatse itself. I knew, alas, that he was not in a position to carry out his kind intentions, and that I could not, therefore, take advantage of the wonderful opportunity he wanted to give me for Oriental research. The Tashi Lama is a learned, enlightened, and liberal-minded man. People who are not in the least acquainted with him have said that he is a backward and superstitious monk, the enemy of foreigners and all that pertains to Western civilization. This is completely wrong. It may be that the great Lama of Tashi Lumpa does not like one particular nation, that he resents the servitude in which the British government keeps his country. No one can blame him for being a patriot, and it is still more difficult to find fault with him because, as a Buddhist, he is a pacifist and does not encourage those who increase each year the taxes paid by the poorest villagers in order to support the ridiculous army they have been led to organize to serve the interests of the very people who seize their land. A Westerner may have ideas about the necessity or usefulness of colonization, the subjection of less civilized people, and be somewhat justified in his views. But the Asiatic who sees his country enslaved is still more justified in lacking friendly months in the capital. In 1846 the Lazarus missionaries Hugh and Gay Bet reached Lhasa. Unveiling of Lhasa, these two French priests were the last travelers to enter Lhasa freely. After the British expedition, apart from political officers and their doctors, no foreigner has been allowed to go to Lhasa. Amongst Europeans who went to Tibet, may also be named Bogle in 1774 and Turner in 1753. These two did not visit Lhasa. They were sent from India to Shigatse as emissaries of Warren Hastings to the Tashi Lama. As for myself, I profoundly despise everything which is connected with politics, and carefully avoid mixing in such matters. In writing this I only wish to do justice to my kind host. If he had been the ruler of Tibet, instead of being compelled to fly from Tashi Lumpa to save his life, he would have gladly opened the country to explorers, savants and all honest and well-meaning travelers. As a result of my visit to Shigatse, the inhabitants of a village situated about 12 miles down the hill from the hermitage where I lived had to pay immediately a fine amounting to 200 rupees for having failed to inform the British authorities of my departure. The resident who sentenced them did not take the trouble to consider that these men had no knowledge whatever of my move, since I started from a monastery situated in Tibetan territory, 3 or 4 days' march away from their village. The latter revenged themselves, according to their primitive mentality of savages, in partly looting my cottage. I complained in vain. No justice was accorded me and I was given 14 days to leave the country. These uncivilized proceedings made me wish to retaliate, but in a witty way, befitting the spirit of the great city in which I had the privilege of being born. A few years later, while traveling in Kham, I fell ill and wished to proceed to Ba Tang to be nursed there by the foreign doctors at the mission hospital. Ba Tang is an important Tibetan town under Chinese control, as is also Kans, in which neighborhood I happened to be at that time. But since the Lhasa troops had conquered the region between these two places, it had been declared forbidden to foreigners. The officer in charge of the frontier post inquired if I carried a permit from the British consul at Tachai Enlu, the Tibetan town at the extremity of the Kham province, being included in Sichuan. Great man of Tachai Enlu, he called him. With this permit, he added, I could go wherever I liked in Tibet, but he could not let me proceed without it. However, I continued on my way, only to be stopped a few days later and to be told again about the great man of Tachai Enlu, holder of the keys of the Forbidden Land. In the meantime, my health grew worse. I explained my case quite freely to the Tibetan officials with all the realistic details necessary to describe a severe attack of enteric, in which the language of Tibet is indeed rich. But it was of no use. The fear of the great man of T'Chai Enlu overpowered the natural kindness of the terrorized officers with whom I had to deal. But although I had to give up all hope of being attended by the doctors at Bardang, I refused energetically to retrace my steps, as I was ordered to do. I decided to go to Jakiendo, a market town situated on the Lhasa Road, beyond the conquered area, still in the hands of the Chinese. Jakiendo lies at the extreme southeast of the desert of grass. I knew that I could find there, if I lived to reach it, the pure milk and curd which might cure me. Moreover, I suspected that a trip through the territory newly brought under the Lhasa rule might prove interesting. I therefore kept firm to my resolve. A full account of the days spent in argument would sound like an epic poem of olden days, half comic, half sad. At last, when each and all had clearly understood that unless they shot me they could not prevent me from going to Jakiendo, I went on my way through the newly forbidden enclave. My hopes were not disappointed. That trip was interesting in all respects, and became the starting point of a period of wanderings truly wonderful. While at Jakiendo I met an unfortunate Danish traveller who, like a number of others, had been stopped near Chang Nak Hukia, the frontier post on the trade route from Mongolia to Lhasa. That gentleman, as his journey had been cut short against his will, wished to return quickly to Shanghai. The road he should have followed crosses the very tract of land on which I had fought my battle with the authorities. Before he had even reached it, soldiers who had been posted to watch their passage prevented him from going forward. The poor traveller turned out to be another wandering Jew and was compelled to recross the desert of grass. He had to organize a caravan to carry food and baggage for a journey lasting at least 1 month, through a wild region which has a particularly bad name for being haunted by large gangs of armed robbers. And even then he reached the extreme northwest of the Chinese border, while he had wanted to come through to the coast. This meant another journey of about 2 months. This meaningless tour could have been avoided by following the direct road, which can be traveled in a sedan chair, without any caravan, food and inns being found on every day's march. Thus half the total time would have been saved. Such stories as this were not without their effect upon me. More than ever I decided to enter once more this land so jealously guarded. I therefore planned to reach the banks of the Salween, and to visit the hot valleys of Sawarong and Zarong. Would I have gone from there to Lhasa? Perhaps, but more likely I would have followed some track toward Lutsikiang or Zayil and travelled, in an opposite direction, a part of the much longer journey which I was to complete successfully 18 months later. I started from Jakiendo at the end of the winter, travelling on foot and accompanied by only one servant. Most passes were blocked by the snow, and we experienced dreadful hardships in negotiating some of them. We had happily surmounted material obstacles, crossed the frontier post under the very windows of the official who guarded it, and were nearing the Salween, when we were stopped. I myself had not been detected, but my luggage, containing some instruments and various requisites for botanical research, betrayed me. This small caravan was in charge of Mr. Yongnan, a young Tibetan, the faithful companion of many of my journeys, and my adopted son. Though he travelled several days' march behind me and trusted to be taken as a trader, the contents of the boxes he carried revealed his connection with me. He was stopped, men were dispatched to look for me through the country, and thus my trip was brought to an end. Was then that the idea of visiting Lhasa really became implanted in my mind. Before the frontier post to which I had been escorted I took an oath that in spite of all obstacles I would reach Lhasa and show what the backslash/rill of a woman could achieve. But I did not think only of avenging my own defeats. I wanted the right to exhort others to pull down the antiquated barriers which surround, in the center of Asia, a vast area extending approximately from 79 to 99 degrees longitude. Had I spoken after my attempts had failed, Some might have thought that I did it out of vexation. Now that success has been mine, I can calmly expose the obscure situation of Tibet today. Perhaps some of those who read of it will remember that if heaven is the Lord's, the earth is the inheritance of man, and that consequently any honest traveler has the right to walk as he chooses, all over that globe which is his. Before ending, I wish to assure my many English friends that my criticism of the part their government has played in this situation is not the outcome of bad feelings against the English nation as a whole. Quite the opposite. I have, from my early youth, when I spent my school holidays on the Kentish coast, liked the company of English people, as well as their ways. My long stay in the East has greatly increased that feeling, to which I now add a sincere gratitude for so many hearty welcomes in so many houses where kind ladies have endeavored to make me feel as if I were in my real home. In their country, just as in mine or in any other one, the policy of the government does not always represent the best side of the nation's mind. I suppose that the citizens of Great Britain and the Dominions are as little acquainted with the demons proceedings of political offices regarding far-off colonies or protectorates, as is the rest of the world. It follows that they cannot resent criticisms which are not addressed to them. What I have said may even astonish many of them, especially Christian missionaries, who may rightly ask why a self-styled Christian nation should forbid the entrance of the Bible and its preachers into a land where she is at liberty to send her troops and to sell her guns. I must add a word regarding the spelling of the Tibetan names in this book. I have merely given them phonetically, without trying to follow the Tibetan spelling, which is very misleading for those who are not acquainted with that language and capable of reading it in its own peculiar characters. As an instance, I will say that the word pronounced Nalger is written the name of Dolma is written Sjrolma, and so on. As for the name Tibet, it may be interesting to know that it is a word unknown in the Tibetan language. Its origin is not quite clearly traced, but Tibetans ignore it completely. Chapter 1. Farewell. We are off. At the bend of the path I look back once more, one last time. Standing at the gate of his residence I see the foreign missioner who welcomed Yongdan and me a few days ago when, without being in the least acquainted with him, we begged his hospitality. Some anxiety may be detected in his kind smile and his intent gaze. To what extent have we succeeded in deceiving that most excellent man? I cannot tell. He does not know the object of our journey, there is no doubt about that, but the program we laid before him was vague enough to awaken the suspicion that we were trying to conceal the fact that we were to undertake a dangerous expedition. Where would we be going, alone, on foot and without luggage, he wonders. He cannot guess, and I am certain that the names of the mysterious wayfarers who slept for a few nights under his roof will be remembered in his prayers. May his own wishes be ever fulfilled. May he be blessed for the warmth that his cordiality adds to the glorious sunshine that lights my fifth departure for the forbidden land of snow. Farewell. We have turned the corner of the road, the mission house is out of sight. The adventure begins. This is, as I have said, my fifth journey into Tibet, and very different, indeed, have been the circumstances and manner of these successive departures. Some have been joyful, enlivened by the babbling and broad laughter of the servants and the country folk, the jingling of the bells hung on the moles' necks, and that rough yet gay fuss that the people of Central Asia so love. Others were touching, grave, almost solemn, when, dressed in the full lamaist garb of dark purple and golden brocade, I blessed the villagers or the dokpas, who had congregated to pay for the last time their respects to the Kandhama of foreign land. I have also known tragic departures, when blizzards raged in the solitudes, sweeping across awe-inspiring white landscapes of impassable snow and ice, soon to be wrapped again in dead silence. But this time the bright sun of the Chinese autumn shines in a deep blue sky, and the green wooded hills seem to beckon us, promising pleasant walks and happy days. With our two coolies carrying a small tent and an ample supply of food, we look as if we were starting for a mere tour of a week or two. In fact, this is precisely what we have told the good villagers whom we have just left, namely, that we are going for a botanical excursion in the neighboring mountains. What would be the end of this new attempt? I was full of hope. A previous experience had proved to me that in the disguise of a poor traveler I could escape notice. But although we had already succeeded in leaving quietly behind the baggage brought with us to cross China, we had yet to assume our full disguise and, most difficult task, to get rid of the two coolies whom we were compelled to take with us to avoid the gossip which would certainly have spread in the mission house amongst the servants and neighbors, had they seen a European lady setting out with a load upon her back. I had, however, already thought of a way of freeing myself from the coolies. My plan depended, it is true, upon certain circumstances over which I had no control, and any little unforeseen incident might wreck it, but I could not think of a better one, and so relied upon my good luck. We had started late, and our first stage was rather short. We encamped on a small and sheltered tableland near which one could get a beautiful view of the highest peak of the Kakapo Range here. The place is called the Vulture's Cemetery because once a year the Chinese slaughter hundreds of these birds that to procure their feathers, with which they do a big trade. They attract the birds with the carcass of a horse or a mule as bait, capture them with nets, and when the poor creatures are caught in the meshes they beat them to death. The plucked bodies are then used as bait to scare other vultures, which in turn share the fate of the first comers. This plucking of vultures' feathers lasts for a whole month amidst putrefaction and pestilence. Happily, when I reached that I spot it was not the vulture killing season, and I saw only heaps of bleached bones amongst the short and thorny vegetation which covers the ground. Dokfers, literally, inhabitants of the solitudes, the cowmen who do not practice husbandry. Footnote. A kind of incarnated fairy. Nature has a language of its own, or maybe those who have lived long in solitude read in it their own unconscious, inner feelings and mysterious foreknowledge. The majesty Kakapo, towering in a clear sky lit by a full moon, did not appear to me that evening as the menacing guardian of an impassable frontier. It looked more like a worshipful but affable deity, standing at the threshold of a mystic land, ready to welcome and protect the adventurous lover of Tibet. The next morning I saw again the huge peak of Kakapo shining at sunrise, and it seemed to smile encouragement to me with all its glittering snows. I saluted it and accepted the omen. That night I slept at the entrance of a gorge in which a tributary of the Mekong roared loudly, a wild, picturesque spot enclosed between dark reddish rocks. The morrow was to be a decisive day. It would see me at the foot of the track that leads to the Doka Pass, which has become the frontier of the self-styled independent Tibet. My scheme was to be tested there. Would it work as I hoped? Would the COO lies leave me without suspecting anything of my designs? Would the situation of that village of Londera, about which I had but little information, favor an escape by night over a small path leading, higher up on the hills, to the pilgrimage road round the Kakapo, which crosses the Doka Pass? A number of questions arose in my mind, each with its own anxiety. However, as I lay on the ground, in the small tent that Yongt had made himself in the Lilo's country, that particular happy feeling of ease and freedom which the stay in solitary places always brings to me wrapped my mind in bliss, and I went to sleep calm as a child lulled by fairy tales. Next morning, leaving my old friend, the Mekong, we turned westward through the rocky gorge at the entrance of which we had slept. Soon it opened out into a narrow, densely wooded valley. The weather was sunny and walking easier. We passed two mounted Tibetan traders, who gave us scarcely a glance. Perhaps they thought we were Chinamen, for Yongden and I both wore Chinese dresses. Nevertheless, this first meeting, precursor of the many which were to follow, gave us a little shock. Although we were yet in that part of Tibet, still under Chinese rule, wherein foreigners can travel freely, though at their own risk, it was most important that rumors of my wanderings in the neighborhood of the border should not spread. For the Tibetan officials, once warned and on the alert, would have the road carefully watched, which would greatly increase the difficulties of our entering the forbidden area. A little before noon we came in sight of Londera. Had we been alone, Yongden and I, we could have easily avoided passing through the village by hiding ourselves in the wood until evening. It would have saved us much trouble and fatigue, for between the steep slopes of the Kakapo range which we were about to climb, there was but the width of this torrential river which we had followed upwards and crossed several times in the narrow gorge.